Say it again for the mass audience out there in video audio tape land. This is just like a videotape, except you don't have to watch it. The one thing that's been brought to our attention, the one thing we've known since 1975, that is, if you pick the correct pace line or a predictive pace line, there's no such thing as the right or wrong pace line. There's the one that is truly predictive of what the horse will do today in relationship to his competition, its competition. We have always been a little bit lacking in pace line selection. And when I say we, I'm talking about the group as a composite throughout North America. Once proper pace lines are selected, our people go to astronomical heights sometimes in their wind proficiency, 80-88% if they're selective in the races, and the average of about 72% for those who play most of the races in a given card other than maidens. The trick is that initial decision, which line shall I use? In the Las Vegas seminar, we started off in a chaotic moment of picking races with 100 people, all of whom wanted to pick a different pace line for the first race we tried. It took us hours. But Dick Schmidt patiently waded through and let the assembly pick the pace line. And Jim Quinn, who was there, who is probably as good as that as anybody, from a little bit different perspective than ours sometimes, but ends up with the same horse, just shook his head in bewilderment and asked if it was all right, asked Tom and myself if it was all right, if he would scold the entire group when his presentation time came, saying, "What is wrong with you people? You have, and this is an outsider's opinion, you have the most powerful tool for picking winners and separating losers from winners once you get the right horses in that there's ever been devised, and yet you're screwing up." He didn't say that because he has a PhD. No. But what you're doing is you're fouling up the detail because you're putting in the wrong pace line, and you don't see automatic disqualifications, and you don't see that you don't take a horse who's going into a stakes race today off of a $50,000 claiming line and think he's going to beat the stakes horse because he ran those fast times, or you don't take a maiden wire-to-wire winner and put it into an allowance for twice the purse of the maiden race and say it's going to do that against these kinds of horses. These are just germane to fundamental handicapping, some of the things that he brought out. So today, we're going to start on pace line selection from the very simplistic form that we gave it to you in the pace line tapes that accompanied the first factor analysis workbook, to get into some more of the esoteric means of picking pace lines. We're going to show you how to use the matchup in determining the pace lines. We're going to show you how to use form cycle analysis in picking pace lines, simple class delineation in picking pace lines, and as well as the more conventional concepts, which are, when I say conventional, the use of par times translated into par energy is somewhat unique to the method, but it's very fundamental. And it's precisely what Tom Brohammer is using in making his variants. Just for purposes of definition, so that there will not be this "yeah, buts," my variant figure that Tom uses is different than the one that UltraScan, any synergetic compounding of velocities, feet per second velocities, is an energy figure. In other words, if you have a second call of 58 and a third fraction of 5280, once you combine them and average them, the figure that you get is not a feet per second figure. It is an arbitrarily conceived and weighted or arithmetically contrived energy figure. If the formula is second call twice plus third fraction divided by 3 plus true speed divided by 2, that is an energy figure. That is total energy. If it's factor W, that's still total energy. So when Tom talks about his variant figure, don't say, what's the difference between that and total energy? That is, by Tom's formula, total energy. Those of you who are using his variant service will then, of course, use that as total energy. Those of you who are making your own variants will use the total energy formula that accompanies that in your computers. So there's no difference. The only difference is the number. The relationship is the same. There are 14, 15, 20, whatever steps in class there are, and you'll find that they encompass about 1.5 total, and they're divided by the levels. There are 10 levels, and it's a 0.15 per level. So if it comes out 0.17 on one program per level, or 0.15 on another program per level, or if even 0.20 on another program per level, as long as you use that program for total energy, you will get the same delineation. If you're using Tom's variant service, you don't give a damn because you're putting in the results of his work and not your own, so it doesn't matter. But total energy is an energy figure that designates the total result of the compounding of fractions from which a variant or an adjustment figure is derived. The formula may change. You may have two different formulas for atomic bombs, but they both explode. Two different formulas for condensed milk. Two different formulas for Alka-Seltzer. They're slightly different. This stuff is different from aspirin, but, you know, it's twice as strong type of thing. But it's still an analgesic. So any questions on that? This is the most disturbing thing you get, because if someone says, but I can't make my numbers match what's in here, therefore I cannot accept what's in here, is pretty awful, because we cannot make them all match. You see, you might be 0.04. Bob Purdy gets calls in the middle of the night about 0.04 difference in his numbers and theirs. And believe me, we send him the flowers to his widow on regular occasions. But so don't worry about these slight deviations from your numbers and ours. Now, if you get something like Dan got, where you get 0 for the second call and 28 for the final fraction, then you got a little problem, but we correct those. Take you through conventional steps, which I suppose is best described by Brohammer, Schmidt, and although I don't think of them as very conventional, Purdy. And then I'll take you through some steps that are in this manual, which they employ, but all of us employ virtually everything that's in here in one way or another, but we don't do it in this. This is like seeing it in slow motion, what you're getting. A lot of people ask me after they've gone through a 9-hour class to get one horse. They say, you mean I have to go through 9 hours to pick one pace line? No. But it seems like that when you come to a 9-hour class and you don't get more than 3 races done. What happens is, after a while, your mind will absorb all this and it becomes instantaneous, intuitive. It takes us, and I've watched these guys, you think that Brohammer is the most meticulously thorough of us all. He probably is. So maybe it takes him 45 seconds longer in Las Vegas to pick a horse than it takes Jimmy Bradshaw or myself, who are faster because we're young and daring. So what does it take a Brohammer to do everything that we're doing here today? Takes him, I would say, if he's going to play for big money, 14 minutes a race. He's playing for $20, $30, 11 minutes a race. And that's pretty accurate. I'm not fudging on you, am I, Tom? I've seen him do it day in, day out in Vegas and going to the track. He could sit there at the track, and he could do what very few of us can do, talk about the race and still win it. You get me talk. If I talk about a race, forget it. I start hearing myself talk, and then I start, whoa, yeah, but, yeah, I'm as bad as anybody. I don't. What I do is when they start talking, I run off and make a bet, and then as long as I got the bunny in, it's all. You have the audio tape, the initial audio tapes on baseline selection that went with the first factor analysis. A lot of you do. Most of you do. You remember that I said on the opening of those tapes that for years, I was very reluctant to talk about techniques for baseline selection because I had learned it intuitively from practice, and I was scared if I verbalized it or intellectualized it, it would go away. Well, this does happen a lot to people who acquire a procedural technique without really knowing how they did it. It becomes intuitive. And it's like, I bet a lot of you wives can pick pace lines, and your husband will say, now where'd you come up with that, honey? If he calls you honey, dumb broad or whatever he calls you. And all of a sudden you get scared. You say, I don't know, dear. And pretty soon you this marvelous intuition, you try to intellectualize it and it goes away. I have this experience that when you try to say, when someone asks you, puts the question to you, how did you do that? You've had it, haven't you? See, that women are not more intuitive than men. It's just they live in a man-oriented society which forces them to be intuitive to exist. Otherwise, they would merely be vessels of man's desire. Now, instead of our mistresses and masters or whatever. Well, to a certain age. So intuition is in reality nothing more than the combination of experience, learning, and putting into practice that and putting it into practice successfully. And that's what we all go on. Remember we talked about the correct pace line looming up from the page? And if everybody say looming up from the page, geez, I go through. At one time or another in everyone's development, if they're going to be successful, unless they fight it, one time or another it will suddenly come to you where it will loom up from the page, it's the correct one. So I see some nodding. People always say, that's not the way. What are you talking, looming up from the page? I come to a classroom to learn. How many of you truly believe that you can learn by just getting information? You'd still believe that, do you, Milo? All right, hold your guns. It's possible that that everyone can learn by just getting information. But anybody in the behavioral scientific field will tell you that you can learn about 1,000 times faster if you allow your intuition to sift the facts through than you will by trying to intellectualize it. Most of you have gotten to this. In a little thing we've given you here today, a supplement to the manual, we talk about the silver mind control people, and we talk about our early experiments using biofeedback procedures to teach baseline selection. You can visualize through mind control. Mind control doesn't mean they control your mind. It means you learn how to control your mind by going into alpha, which is the state that meditative people go into. They don't talk very well, but they it's like that hypnagogic state you go into when you're in just before you go to sleep, in that dream state, just when you're coming out of sleep, everything's so wonderful and you're seeing everything clear. Alcohol and certain drugs produce the momentary alpha. Unfortunately, the resultant after effects aren't worth the momentary alpha, but when you feel that you really have a grasp of everything, you're in alpha. But we are mostly in beta. Beta is our conscious awareness state where everything has to be 1, 2, 3, orderly. Fact, fact, fact. This fact fits this fact, and if this is true, this must therefore be true, and ergo, this is the baseline. That's another way to do it. That's the intellectualization of it. But the other way, of course, produces much better results. Intuition really is the result of little alpha stages we go through in the learning process, where the end result is you look at a race, and even though you just don't intellectualize it, you see the factors that are essential to see, in picking the pace line. So what we're going to do today is we'll beta this thing. We'll do it for Milo, and we'll give it in pure information. But when you absorb the information, then the whole sum total, the gestalt of it, puts you on the right pace line automatically. So when someone suggests an incorrect pace line, and we're going to ask sharp questions, we're going to confront you, in other words, just like in a therapeutic group. If you say, I think we should use that line, we're going to say, why? And don't be offended if we jump on you. But it won't be jumping on you in the sense of disciplining. It'll be jumping on you for an immediate reaction from your mind, like in a word association test. I say red, you say green, blah, blah, blah. And then I say mother, and you go, blah, blah, blah. And so we're going to confront you. Why did you, you know? And maybe this will help you sense, by a little shock, these problems that we're engulfing.
Today, are you going to, in talking about energy and using energy for pace line selection, explain how to use it in contender scan? I've seen that energy figure in my contender scan program, but I just don't really understand. Is that total energy when I see that? And can you get par times off of that and use? Okay.
Yeah. The contender scan program is probably the best thing we've ever done in a sense, except everyone insists on adjusting it. The contender program, scan program, is best used raw, except when you're adjusting from distance changes and things like that, because it has a tolerance level. Yes, sir.
Contender scan, what is factor S in there? S.
Sorry.
is that a measurement of something in the race?
It's the best. That is one of the best formulas. See, we always look for a formula. There are ways to do deceleration formulas that are very complex. You take the percentile relationship of the horse's energy of the total race to his fastest time, to his slowest time, and you do all sorts of things mathematically. Make you look like a genius. But you will get virtually the same results if you take the first and the third fraction divided by 2, then throw in the second fraction and divide the whole thing by 2, which is factor S. It takes not only into, that's what you're getting on there, it takes not only in consideration the horse's ability to reach a point of speed, which is in the first fraction, measures how he handles his speed to his slowest moment, which is the third fraction, relative to how he handled that important turn time, second fraction. Okay, now we've all got our terms straightened, so we'll know what we're talking about here. The most important point in a horse race is the second call, which is a half mile in a sprint and a three-quarter mile in a route. That is the most important point. Where a horse is in relation to that is the most predictive element in the race. It is more predictive than where a horse is in relationship to the other animals in the first fraction. More important than it would be just measuring the second fraction by itself. More important than measuring the third fraction by itself. The second call is the focal point in a race. That I've read throughout racing literature. Now that I've come up with all these things, you go back 40 years and you'd be surprised how many guys stole all this stuff from us. But virtually every important writer from the 20s on has delineated the second call as the most significant point in the race. Not that you have to be in the lead at the second call, or not how fast you ran at the second call, but where you were at the second call in relationship to today's competition. Because Bob Purdy, in an exhaustive computer study of our tracks, has demonstrated how many lengths a horse can be off at the second call and still win a race, and it's very measurable at all of Southern California, and we've done it around the country, racetracks. They can be farther away at the fairgrounds in New Orleans and at Churchill Downs and at Belmont and at Hollywood than they can at Santa Anita, but the track, the configuration or contour of a given racetrack determines precisely at any given distance just where a horse has to be at the second call in order to win on a given circumstance, surface, etc. Sir?
On the contender scan, on the dream pace, and then all the figures that go below it, can you use those feet per second? Is that...
Those are feet per second figures. Yeah. Contender scan gives you first fraction,
right,
second fraction, third fraction, and second call.
But in other words, your number one pace, that would be the horse that would be second call. The number one feet per second and the second call would be... tend to be one of the favorites as far as you're concerned.
Unless
the track is running sustained.
Yeah.
You know, it's relative to what the Brohammer model is the greatest achievement in handicapping, because everybody else dedicated themselves to handicapping horses. The Brohammer model, which we named after Tom Brohammer because he took the ball that we got laddered to us by Huey Moll, and I laddered it then to Tom, and he took it down the field. Well, I don't know, maybe he shot a hole in the wall. Like, yeah, but he shot a hole in the wall. He's a golfer, not a football player. He took it and he put it into the hole. The Brohammer model is... The Brohammer model is to handicapping tracks what the feet per second analysis is to handicapping horses. You got to handicap the two of them together to be a big winner. You can win 63% and not give a damn what the tracks, how the track's running. If you want to get up there and get those higher mutuals, you've got to handicap the track with the same meticulous pursuit that you handicap the horses. And that's what we've got in common. By having great minds join the group, we were able to progress on your behalf. Since Tom's drinking his coffee, let me bring you the man who preceded Tom with us by, oh, I think 3 weeks. The man who was so brilliant in his use of the method that the day he got it, he won a $60,000 pick six. $30,000 pick six. It's been a while, you know, it keeps growing. And the next day he opened the envelope that had the method in it. We call him handicapping and picking pace lines from the bottom up, because unlike most of you, I'm sure, and most like unlike me when I started looking at the last pace line and working down, looking for an excuse for the last, if I could go beyond it, working back. And sometimes I never got all the way to the bottom. That's dumb. I found that out. Here's a man who starts from the bottom up. Just get the horse's total form cycle picture. Bob Purdy.
It's a good habit or a bad habit, but he's right about from the bottom up. When I open up the form and start looking at the horses, I just go to the last pace line that they have, all the way down to the bottom, and work my way up to the top, looking at the horse's form cycle, trouble lines, and whatever is there to see. Yeah, right now? Page 39 of the manual is a little note from Glenn Smock. The reason I'm bringing this up is because Glenn does what I do. He reads from the bottom up. And he's gone back to using the pluses and O's. And this is an indication of one day at the track, or possibly 2 days, I think, using the pluses and O's. And he just starts at the bottom, working his way up and marking the good performances and the bad performances. The preview to the follow-up had the X's and pluses and O's in it. So all of you should have this and know how to do it. I don't do this, but I suggest that you do. I do this mentally without marking down the pluses and the O's, but that's exactly what I'm doing, is looking for this format. Good performance, bad performance, why, and what have you.
In the money or within 4.5 lengths.
I don't care what it is. What I'm telling you, find out what it is and use it, okay? Because it'll help you analyze the horse's form cycle and what kind of an animal you're dealing with today. And that's what you really want to know. What kind of shape is this animal in today? Most important. And I really have to hand it to Glenn. You know, he's been 73 now for at least 5 years that I'm aware of. A man who quit school sometime before 1920 in the fourth grade to support his family. But you can teach an old dog new tricks, because he has improved his handicapping tremendously just by going back to doing this. And you can do the same thing. Just do it by rote, automatically. Know that before you pick your pace lines, you probably ought to look for the pluses and os and mark them down so they're visible. And it'll point not only to the pace lines, but to the contenders in the race today. So you don't have to stop and pick pace lines for non-contenders in this field.
Interpret
them after you got them on. Read the thing in the following. I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't do it. I do it mentally. I just look for good performances and bad performances. This is a system, if you want to call it that, of what I do mentally.
I'll learn this book, but I'll get to it a little bit later in more detail.
And that's basically the way I do it. My final analysis of any trouble line is very simple. Did the trouble affect the horse's performance or his ability to compete in that race? If it did, then I will excuse it and go to another line. If it didn't affect the outcome of the race and had no effect on his performance, or a measurable effect, a significant effect, I'm not going to excuse it. Sometimes these chart callers, they put trouble lines in there just because they got nothing else to do, I guess. And they don't really mean a lot. If it did not affect the outcome of the race, to my way of thinking, then I'm not going to excuse it. That horse is going to have to live with that pace line.
You don't care if he was bumped, but if he was checked, you don't like that.
Well, was he checked and did it out? Usually you can see. If he was checked at the eighth pole when he's in contention going for the wire, and he's got the lead or he's off by a neck at the stretch call, and then he finishes up the track, then I know he was seriously checked and it affected the outcome. I'll excuse that. If he was a neck off, checked, and still won the race, I'm not going to worry about that trouble line. It didn't affect the outcome. He still won it anyway. Let me ask a question. How many of you are actually using the pluses and os? Two, three? I suggest all of you get it out. That was a gold mine that was sent to you, and use it. It will seriously improve your pace line picking. There's no doubt about it. If a 73 plus 10 years or whatever it is, old man can do it, you guys can do it.
What'd you say about the doing it for just the contenders? Is that what you said?
These will point out the real contenders in the field. Some people have trouble picking contenders in a race. They look at 12 horses in a race and which one of these are contenders today. This will point them out for you real quick. You'll know which ones are the contenders and which ones aren't, and you won't be wasting your time picking pace lines for horses that have no business in this field. Okay? That's about all I have to say, Howard, unless anybody has any questions.
So you're saying by using this that field way of qualifying
the contenders in the field, right?
How far do you feel safe to go back when there's no pace
line? Let us let that evolve throughout the day.
There is no distinction of how far to go back. You have to make that call each and every time you look for a pace line. There is no set time to go back.
I've hesitated like going back for a year.
Figured, well, gee, that's... What if it's the only pace line you can possibly
use? And you really feel the horse is a contender. You don't have any other choices then, do you? You either use the pace line, knowing that it's a year old, and accept that, or just don't use the horse.
Yesterday, I made a mistake that might be very apropos here, was the fact that a horse from Turf Paradise, and he raced one Canterbury Downs, had been off for about a year. But his past performance was absolutely great. In fact, he'd only finished out of once out of the money in the last 10 races. But he'd only worked out once at Turf Paradise, once 3 furlongs at Santa Anita in the past year. That's all he's done. I threw him out and he won the race. Who am I exactly?
Rarely do I pay much attention to workouts, particularly for shippers. I don't know.
He was off a year.
You know, the trainer must know something about the horse. He must know how to train the horse. That's his job.
He had a great record, though. Really great.
The trainer obviously knew what he was doing.
Let me give you a little story that Huey Moll told. He used to get, as he started buying horses, now going back a year is a... You know, sometimes you can pick. I missed it. The guy says, "Yeah, but Howard, that was 1985. Oh, really? Yes. It was in April. That's current. If the horse wins, then you're right. If it loses, then it's a dumb thing to do. But the fact that he had nothing but pluses, and probably the other horses had a lot of O's, and it was in a race where his pluses were plus enough. But Huey said, as he got more and more knowledgeable, he started buying horses, and he got in with owners and trainers, and he said his handicap fell all apart. So he had his wife glue little pieces of blank paper over the name of the trainer, the jockey, the workouts, the date of the last race, and all those little pertinent things, earnings. And he just then went to what the horse had done. And he said his handicapping improved immeasurably, despite the fact that he had become an owner and was a confidant of trainers and jockeys. That's the only way you can keep on winning, is to ignore a lot of the information that other people rely solely on. Maybe it's apocryphal, maybe it's a joking story, but it had a point.